Okay, well, first of all, just thank you. That was just amazing listening to the points that you both made. And it's quite humbling, actually, just to see how much work you've put into trying to sort of get under the skin of what I've been trying to do. So I really, really am very appreciative of that. I'm sure there were more points that you would have liked to make, but I'm very appreciative of what you've done, and I'll try my best. I did have the advantage of having Bob's remarks in advance, so I have been able to sort of prepare the ground there. But with Elena, obviously, I'm trying my best, although I think actually the points I want to add to what you've said, but I think we agree on quite a lot of things, actually, which itself was reassuring, I have to say. Okay, so let's get going. Now Bob has a number of points to make, and the first one I'm going to consider is concerns an issue that we've discussed over the years, since for some bizarre reason Bob started getting interested in pragmatism. Don't ask me where that happened. But anyway, since then, take no turns. We've had these discussions. But Bob makes some really important points on the basis of the pragmatism argument. And I should just say that these don't really apply to the phenomenology. I think we're agreed that much of what you're looking for from a more pragmatist Hegel is delivered perhaps more by the phenomenology. The question really concerns the logic and the beginning of the logic. Okay, so let me have a go at that. First of all, Bob announced that we both agree that in some sense Hegel's philosophy is supposed to be presuppositionless. That doesn't mean that there aren't presuppositions to presuppositionless philosophy. It means it's systematically presuppositionless, not hermeneutically, for example. And that we do agree in many ways on what that actually means. But as Bob puts it, we don't necessarily agree about what drives Hegel to that point of view in the first place. Now, obviously, I can't go through everything, but I just want to highlight what I see as an assumption, if I can put this way, in Bob's own understanding of the motive behind Hegel's interest in presuppositionlessness. So let me just read you a couple of things that Bob said, and then you see whether you can hear what I'm hearing in this. So at one point, Bob said, the pragmatist's objection to my approach is roughly that doubt requires some grounds or basis. So we should not, for example, question our cognitive capacities unless we have reason to think that they are leading us astray. Doubt requires some grounds or basis. We should not question our cognitive capacities unless we have reason to think they're leading us astray. Bob then turns to talk about freedom of thought, which he recognizes quite rightly as being, for me, and for the Hegel that I understand, absolutely central. But he says that freedom, from his point of view, doesn't require a global clearing away of presuppositions. Rather, anything we think can be questioned if it turns out that we have reason to do so. So I'm perfectly at liberty. I'm perfectly at liberty to doubt it should this prove necessary. So what we seem to be getting here is the idea that to doubt something, you've got to have reason to doubt it. There's got to be a ground. And I think that is the problem. But I don't think that's what Hegel's got in mind. And it's interesting that this suggests to me, and this is, I guess, while bypassing a number of the more detailed points that Bob made about presuppositionlessness, that Bob and Bob's Hegel assumes from the start that to think is to have and provide reasons and grounds, and that this applies just as much to the skeptic as anybody else. Indeed, Bob's attachment to reasons is evident in his claim that unfree thought accept beliefs, I quote, the reasons for which are unknown. Or in other words, that, I quote, unfreedom arises because presuppositions lack a proper grounding. Now, on my understanding of Hegel, at least in at the beginning of the logic, when he's in his sort of absolutely skeptical mode, the problem is not just that presuppositions lack grounding, lack reasons. Because for him, grounds, reasons, would just be other presuppositions. Hegel thinks that a ground for something ultimately rests on an assumption. So the problem with the pragmatist conception of doubt that I think Bob is setting forth is that one would just be pushing the presupposition one stage further down. If you've got reasons to be skeptical about a presupposition, then you're just presupposing those reasons as far as Hegel's concerned. There is a little bit of kind of Wittgenstein uncertainty about Hegel, that whenever you go for an argument, you've got some underlying assumption behind that. So the point for Hegel is to get rid of all the assumptions, just get rid of them. And I think that applies also to the very idea of having reasons for doubting. So that's where I think we differ. That I think that whatever thought and freedom turn out to be later in the logic, at the beginning, for Hegel, freedom involves what he calls an abstracting, a doing away with all assumptions. And the overriding reason for doing that is that those assumptions represent something fixed and determinate, which in that respect alone already put a limit on freedom in its initial form. Now, it's worth pointing out here again that I think something Bob didn't highlight is the issue all concerns the beginning. How do we begin? So Hegel's not making a grand claim that freedom in all and every respect will always mean getting rid of assumptions. But to begin with, freedom in its initial form, Hegel thinks, is basically what he calls freedom from. And he argues this point at the beginning of the logic, but also in paragraph 5 of the philosophy of right. The first movement in the philosophy of right is abstracting freedom from everything. And I think that's really where we differ. So that's why I still think Hegel's is not a pragmatist in Bob's sense. I apologize, but I'm going to have to leave it at that because I've got to go through some other points. But anyway, maybe later on we could talk about that. Now, on method and transitions, very good question, which I'm glad to see posed so starkly. When we look on and see one category make a transition to another, what is it that we learn? You know, because if we don't learn anything, what's the point of reading the thing in the book? So I think there's a straightforward answer. So I'll deal with a straightforward answer before I get into this knotty problem as to whether Hegel is a transcendental philosopher, which I think he isn't. So what do we learn? I think, to put it simply, we learn more of what it is to be. We start the logic with pure being, and in the course of the logic, we learn more about what it is to be. We learn that being is not only being, but determinate being, and not just determinate being, but the being of something. And that something is not just something, but what it is in itself and in relation to others, that it has a limit, that it's finite. And the term that Hegel uses to describe what's going on there is that we're going through a process of Weiterbestimmung, further determination. Now, it's self-determination, we're not doing it to being. But Hegel thinks that the logic progresses not by replacing one category with another, but simply through thinking, observing, being, determining itself, so that we discover that it involves quality, quantity, measure, essence, and so on, and indeed eventually proves to be nature. So I think that's what we learn. So logic discloses what being must be, but it does so by showing how being determines itself into these different forms. Now, I'll come back to the point that Bob made later, but about whether or not being just proves to be a kind of fiction at the beginning, because I don't think it does otherwise. Well, if it does, then my reading just collapses completely. But I don't think it does. Okay, so that's what I think we learned. And I think, by the way, because I think the logic is both a logic and an ontology, we also learn about what it is to think. What are the basic categories of thought, and why do they belong to thought? As I said before, why do we think in terms of quantity? I remember having, we had a good friend around, and I think it was when I was working on the book, and she was asking, you know, in all innocence, you know, what are you doing? You know, I said, well, I'm doing the logic, and I was thinking of an example. You know, I was thinking, well, we operate with many categories that we don't often think why we operate with them. Think of quantity, you know, why do we think of things as having size? And she looked at me as if I was a complete moron. Most people don't worry about why we think things have size. But why do we think things have size? And why is there size in being? That's what Hegel's interested in, and that's what the logic is about. Okay, now, I agree with Bob up to a point that there is this, you use the term sort of modal articulation. Yes, clearly, insofar as Hegel's setting out what he thinks being must be. But I don't think it's a transcendental argument. And the reason why has to do with that little pesky word condition. The notion of a condition is discussed in the Logic of Essence. It's a Wesenslogisch term. And obviously Kant uses it, Derrida uses it, a lot of people use it. They ask about the conditions of the possibility of such or the conditions of impossibility of such. I don't think that is Hegel's fundamental strategy. So as we're moving through the logic, we are not essentially moving from being to the conditions of being. This is not to say that, for example, when we get to the concept isn't the self-determining structure within which being and essence are moments. But the argument is not fundamentally transcendental throughout. Indeed, if it were, we'd get into a real mess. So Hegel would be saying things like, quantity is a precondition of quality. No, his point is exactly the opposite, is that quantity is a further form of quality that differs in certain fundamental ways. Or even more oddly, in the logic of the concept, if the account were transcendental, if we were kind of moving forward back into the conditions of where we began, then life would have to be a condition of mechanism. No, Hegel is not claiming that at all. So I think the transcendental reading of the logic is, I don't agree with that. And I think obviously Kant is transcendental philosopher. Fichte is very much more, you begin with these first acts of the self and then you go back into the conditions that make it possible. I don't think that's what Hegel's doing. And I don't think it's what he's doing in the phenomenology either, but that's a separate matter. So yes, necessity, yes, modal articulation, but no, it's not a transcendental argument. And I think this sets Hegel really apart from Fichte, Schelling in certain moments, Schopenhauer. Except Schopenhauer and Schelling are interesting because they have the genetic feature as well. So you could call Hegel's method much more genetic in a sense, development. So again, just if you forgive me, I'm going to stick with that. On the further question, do I ask for a twin-track approach? Do the necessary structures of what we think arise out of the necessary structures of being, or the other way around? I would say, and you'd expect me to say this, that they kind of coincide. There isn't a priority of one over the other, but that logic is about thought and being throughout. And so I would say neither nor on that one. On Pippin, I think you captured pretty well where we differ, because I appreciate it's quite nuanced, because Pippin is not arguing, as people used to think, and I think in some ways I used to think actually, that all we ever are able to articulate is what we think something to be. Pippin highlights that sentence from Kant's A Transcendental Deduction, where he says that what Kant says and what he's setting out, not just the categories that we need, but the categories that are required for something to be an object for cognition. And that's what Pippin is focused on. Pippin thinks that Hegel is setting out the conditions under which something can be an intelligible object for thought. And in that respect, what appears to be a transcendental account in the logic is actually a metaphysics. And of course, more recently, he's associated with Aristotle's metaphysics. And Pippin does also argue that in a way, one can't say, and this is, I think, where I got Pippin a bit wrong earlier, that somehow being kind of the thought that he's articulating falls short of being for Pippin's Hegel, because as Pippin says, the reality side of the dyad is itself conceived by thought. Thought conceives the difference between thought and what's different from it. So, Pippin's Hegel is yet a transcendental philosopher, but also one concerned with metaphysics. But I think Bob is absolutely right that what I'm seeing Hegel as emphasizing is the irreducibility of being as such, and that this is itself what thought thinks. Thought doesn't just think of being for thought, as it were. It thinks being. This is what Fichte misses. Fichte cannot understand being as anything other than Gesetzsein, positiveness. But Hegel thinks that being is irreducible. And I think you're also right, Bob, that Hegel starts with this direct ontological consciousness of being. What I'd just like to add for sort of everybody listening is that this is where I think Descartes becomes very important. I think if you think of what Descartes is doing in the first and the beginning of the second meditation, namely engaging in a process of doubt that leads us to the cogito, I think I exist, or I think therefore I am, however it's expressed. But then take away the I. Don't just take away the thought that I'm a rational animal. Take away the I altogether. Just eliminate the I. What are you left with? That thought, therefore, being. Thought, therefore, is. Thought, in this process of abstracting from all its assumptions, reduces itself to its own immediate being, which is so indeterminate it can't even be thought as the being of thought. It's just indeterminate being as such. Now, that is Descartes' cogito without the I. And I think that means that's what I think Pippin's Hegel is missing, that irreducibility of being. And it's the very thing that Schelling thinks Hegel can't think. It's the that there is. Schelling says Hegel doesn't get anywhere near it. All Hegel can think is sort of what there is, but he can't get the das. And of course, that's the beginnings of existentialism, to tell a rather simplistic story. And I think, no, that's absolutely wrong. That's exactly what Hegel's thinking. The das, the that. Only Hegel's getting there, as it were, through this process of abstract thought. Okay, all right, moving on swiftly to the third point about the beginning with being. Obviously, I don't accept the idea that we fail. I think there are a number of people who do think that we try to think being and then fail, but the failure is instructive because we learn from the failure what the conditions would be of a successful thinking. No, I don't think that's what Hegel is doing at all, although I kind of understand why one might think that. I think, and I think you suspect this, that for Hegel, well, you said it, my Hegel succeeds in thinking being. The question is, what is it to think pure being? It is to think pure being as vanishing into nothing. That's what pure being is. Unless you're Parmenides, and then you want to fix being as being, as being, as being, as being. But Hegel's point is pure being in its absolute purity and indeterminacy is its own vanishing. That's not a failure to think being. That is what it is to think being. And that's why being in and as the vanishing into nothing proves to be becoming. Now, if Bob's going to argue that the beginning of the logic starts with a failure, then how the heck do you get to becoming? You've got no way of getting to becoming, or you've got no way, in the sense of showing that for Hegel, being proves to be becoming. So that, I think, is quite important. So I would say that this means that the conclusion of Hegel's argument is not that there is no such thing as being, or no such thing as pure being. It's that pure being itself impurifies itself by vanishing into nothing and proves thereby to be becoming. So it's that vanishing. I don't see in Bob's Hegel where that vanishing occurs. But Hegel uses the word Verschwinden. And how does he get to determinate being? Through das Verschwinden des Verschwindens, the vanishing of the vanishing. Most people don't worry about that. They just think he's blah, 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 blah. He's just muttering to himself. No, he means it. That when you think through the vanishing properly, it has to vanish through its own logic. So that would be, for me, a reason, I think, why I don't like the idea of the beginning of logic is a kind of failure. Now, but you do raise an important point, this idea that kind of being vanishes and it also doesn't vanish. But why does it not vanish? Well, because the dialectic that besets being also besets nothing. Pure nothing is no more sustainable than pure being is. Pure nothing also proves to be its own vanishing. But that means, what does it vanish into? It vanishes into being. You did quote a line, I think, well, in fact, it's, I think you quoted it anyway, unless I'm just remembering it myself, that being vanishes through its indeterminacy, nothing vanishes through its immediacy. Now, the latter point is important. Hegel's claim is that, despite what Heidegger might say, Hegel is not thinking nothing always already under the sort of shadow of being. He's thinking pure and absolute nothing. It doesn't get more nothing. You can't nuff nothing more than Hegel does. It's pure and utter nothing, but it's the purity, the immediacy of that nothing that means it vanishes into being, because that's all being is at this point, indeterminate immediacy. Now, if you put those two together, what you get at the beginning of the logic is the radical instability of purity. That's why I use the word impurify, even though it violates grammar, no doubt. But being and nothing impurify themselves of themselves through their very purity. They don't need anything else to do it. They do it of their own accord. And that's what sets up the move to becoming. So, yes, Hegel does think we can successfully think being and successfully think nothing, and we think them as their own vanishing. Now, I think this addresses also your last point, namely, is Hegel dealing with the something question or the nihilism question? I have to say, that distinction was really helpful, and I hadn't thought about it. So I appreciate you highlighting that distinction. But now you've made it, I think Hegel is making both of those claims at the same time. And actually, in the passage you quote from me on the handout, which is the for Kant something blah 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 blah, I say, indeed, beginning with nothing leads to the same result, since nothing via becoming and determined being also makes something necessary. So in fact, Hegel is, I think, is addressing the nihilism question as well as the something question. And that's because nothing vanishes as much as being vanishes. All right, I think at that point I need to, because time is moving on, I will leave Bob's ideas, if I may, and pass on to Elena. I mean, I agree with obviously a lot of what you wanted to say. I just wanted to highlight maybe some nuances. And maybe complexities, whether they make the account I'm giving less coherent or more coherent, I'm not sure, but I think they do need to be made. The first point to make, I guess I should say, is you might think, why the heck did I consider Hegel and Frege together? It wasn't actually specifically because of the question of logic. It was to do with the question of number. But that's because at the particular point where this discussion arises in the book, Hegel's just derived the conception of number, which pretty much matches the Greek conception of number, which, of course, everybody else apart from Frege sort of accepts. Namely, number is a sort of a unity or an aggregate of featureless units. And what I wanted to look at was, A, Frege's critique of that, which I don't think works, because I think it rests on overextending the Leibniz's principle of the identity of indiscernibles. We can talk about that afterwards, if that is just going to you. But also to look at the problems with Frege's own derivation and justification of number, which is what I do in the long chapter 5. Having said that, Elena is absolutely right that I do then look at certain similarities between Frege and Hegel to do with logic. And I think you identify them quite right. And I'm really pleased, because you work on logic more than I do, that you think that what I said there isn't completely silly, so that is reassuring. Okay, the nuances. One of the things that I think, and I found it quite difficult to articulate actually, was that for Frege, it's very clear that logic articulates not laws of nature, but the laws of nature. The rules, as it were, that govern our thinking of nature. Now, Hegel's logic also does that, but I think he also wants to argue that it also informs nature. Now, this is controversial, but I think in Hegel's philosophy of nature, he wants to argue there is reason in nature. Now, it's shot through with and mediated by contingencies, and so it is shot through with unreason, which is why nature often deviates from, in a sense, its own natural norms. You know, you get, Hegel uses the word, whether this is quite the term I would use, I don't know, but he uses the term monstrosities, naming natural forms which deviate from the rational norms within nature quite properly, because nature is the sphere of reason and unreason together. Now, I think that is, I think emphasizing the fact that logic, although it is prescriptive, normative for Hegel, as you pointed out, it's also, it belongs to and informs nature in a way I don't think it does for Frege. Now, I don't think that's a difference between this. I just wanted to highlight that point. A similar point I would make about psychologism. I think you're absolutely right that both Frege and Hegel reject psychologism. One should add, perhaps, that, of course, for Hegel, psychology is essentially an empirical discipline. So one of the reasons why, this is not the only reason, but one of the reasons why Hegel rejects psychologism is because he thinks the logic is a priori and psychology is a posteriori. But nonetheless, that he does want to separate the two, and he wants to separate the two because he thinks there is a moment of necessity, normative necessity within the logic. But then there was that passage that you quoted, on the other hand, and you're quite right. So I think I need to say something about that, that the logic articulates how categories should be understood to be conceived properly. It's a normative endeavor. But it also articulates the logical forms that are actual, in actual thought, albeit for the most part, unconsciously and instinctively and abstractly. So the logic isn't just prescribing to us and telling us how we should think. It's, if you like, articulating in a clearer way the true structure of the categories that inform how we do think. Now, you gave the example of the Hegel and the syllogism, and so that's much closer to what I wanted to highlight. But it does mean that you've got to think for Hegel that logic articulates what's actual in thinking as well as what's what we should think. And that is, it seems to me, quite a difference with Frege. Now, I don't think we differ on this, actually. I just wanted to highlight it a little bit more because I think it is quite an important difference. Elena noted that I think of Frege's logic as a Verstandeslogik, the logic of the understanding, and I thought it might be worth just saying a little bit about that, if I've got time. The logic, Hegel distinguishes, as Kant does, between understanding and reason, Verstand and Vernunft. Only Hegel has a somewhat different conception of the difference. Putting it at its simplest, Verstandes thinking is thinking that holds to certain distinctions and oppositions and thinks they're exhaustive. So good is good and bad is bad. Nothing is nothing and being is being. The finite is the finite and the infinite is the infinite. Plato, in many respects, is this. You can, a thing can take on, can have the form of being beautiful and it can lose that and take on the form of being ugly. But what it is to be beautiful can't turn out to be the very form of what it is to be ugly. But Hegel is saying, actually, that's not true. Conceived in certain ways, the very form of the good turns out to be evil. Conceived in certain ways, the very form of the infinite turns out to be finite. And indeed, the finite turns out to be infinite. Verstand will have none of this. And so reason, which articulates this dialectical sort of passing into opposites and tries to think the unity of the moments, is different from Bestand. Now, Frege, it seems to me, doesn't have that conception of reason. He is Verstand all the way in some of the fundamental distinctions he draws: function, argument, concept, object. And they get him into a real mess. And if you don't know anything about Frege, one of Frege's famous claims is the concept horse is not a concept. And that's because to be a concept is to be somehow incomplete, is to be preceded by an indefinite article, and you subsume objects under a concept, so you get a fully developed thought. But if a concept is preceded by an indefinite article, what do we do with the concept horse, which is preceded by the definite article? Well, it becomes an object. So Frege sort of sees the way a concept can slip into being an object, but it's on the basis of an absolutely complete and sharp distinction between being a concept and being an object. Now, Bob and I were talking with Elena as well earlier about the fact that this means that Frege can't deal with Hegel's speculative sentences, because one of the features of Frege's distinction between concepts and objects is that concepts are incomplete, unsaturated, objects are complete. But within Hegel's speculative sentence, both are incomplete. The subject term proves to be what it is through its predicate, and so is not simply what it is on its own. And of course, the predicate itself proves to be the essence of the subject, so it's not what it is on its own either. Neither is complete. Now, Frege can't handle that. He can't handle, it's like incomplete objects, because to be an object just is to be complete. That's a consequence of Verstand thinking. Anyway, I just wanted to say a little bit about that, and that's what I was looking for when reading Frege. Where are there these points that Frege will insist on a distinction between things, even if it means he gets pushed into certain paradoxes? All right, the last point I would just like to make is where I would like to disagree with you, if you don't mind, Elena. And that is where you said, from my point rather alarmingly, that that Hegel's logic corresponds with philosophical logic. I'm happy with that. That is not incompatible with a mathematical approach to logic. Just to say, I'd need to hear a bit more about that, given Hegel's worries about mathematics. You know, he was a little bit of a nerd when he was a schoolboy and used to do, you know, geometry, special geometry tests on a Saturday and Sunday morning to entertain himself. So he knew a lot about mathematics. And he was very good at it. But he doesn't think that mathematics provides a model for logic. And that's because of the way he thinks that mathematics and quantity generally sort of isolate the components. You know, you have 7 isolated, plus isolated, 5 isolated, equals isolated, 12. And so when you have that as a model for logic, he thinks you lose the kind of dialectical fluidity. So I would have thought mathematical logic as we conceive it, symbolic logic as we conceive it, Hegel would think is an oxymoron. And I'd like to talk to you more about that. I think there's a lot more I'd like to say, but I realize I've gone over my time. So I think I'll leave it at that. And thank you again very much for your contribution.